30 years in the future. My great-grandchildren might be able to sit down and have a conversation with me that's based upon all the tweets and emails that I had written, my opinion on current events, my mannerisms.
New services are popping up to let you decide the fate of your digital afterlife. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. What's in a name? Turns out when it comes to the issue of climate change, a whole lot.
What we found is that the terms really do seem to still elicit very different kinds of reactions. The term global warming led to greater certainty that the phenomenon is happening, including a sense of personal threat.
And the media moment that created our false memory of Tom Cruise losing it on the Oprah Winfrey Show.
He doesn't jump on the couch. He gets up and sort of leaps on to stand on it, but he never bounces on it like a trampoline.
All that and more after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. When his revelations first appeared early last June in London's Guardian and the Washington Post, he was like an unidentified flying object that suddenly appeared on our radar screen, flying very close and low.
The biggest news out of Washington today is this. Big Brother is watching you.
The Guardian newspaper reported the NSA has been collecting phone records from millions of Verizon customers under a secret court order.
An unknown source leaked the information to columnist Glenn Greenwald.
And when finally he was identified a few days later in The Guardian, it seemed to generate only more confusion.
The question here all day has been, who is Edward Snowden?
Up until about, 72 hours ago, this guy was a bit of a pipsqueak, and now he's front page all over the world.
He is a 29-year-old high school dropout.
Snowden was living in Hawaii, making $200,000 a year.
Part of the life he left behind involves his long-term girlfriend, a pole dancer.
We've lived with Edward Snowden, his revelations and his personal saga for exactly a year. So let's recap, starting with the crucial stuff of his revelations. Jody Avergan of WNYC's Brian Lehrer Show put together an exhaustive list of what's now known about the surveillance capabilities of the NSA. Jody, read the highlights.
The NSA can track the numbers of both parties on a phone call, as well as location, time, and duration. It can track bank transactions.
Mm-hmm.
It can monitor text messages, also your YouTube views and Facebook likes, in real time.
Mm-hmm.
It can access your email, chat, and web browsing data, map your social networks, and access your smartphone app data.
Mm.
It can intercept and store webcam images, record phone calls, store them, and replay them up to a month later, harvest images from emails and texts and more, and feed it into facial recognition software.
We learned about that last week.
We did. It can crack all sorts of sophisticated computer encryption. It can remotely access a computer by setting up a fake wireless connection. It can set up a fake LinkedIn. Not a fake LinkedIn account, but an entire fake LinkedIn social network. It can build a fake internet cafe. It can make
All right. Okay. I think that'll do it. We'll link to the complete list. But we should stipulate, that's what we know the NSA can do, not necessarily what it does do. Well, actually, it does do a lot of that, and more, with the help of British intelligence, and yes, the German and French, and many others. And of course, China and Russia also have well-documented domestic and foreign surveillance operations. But everyone does it is an unpersuasive argument to the many Americans who have seen their presumed right to privacy upended. To them, Snowden's an unambiguous hero.
Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers in 1971, calls Snowden a national hero.
I think that he gives me hope that we may actually regain our Bill of Rights.
The executive director of the ACLU praising NSA leaker Edward Snowden, saying he did this country a service by spurring debate about the reach of the U.S. government's electronic surveillance programs.
And here's former Congressman Ron Paul.
He's telling the truth, and this is what we are starved for. The American people are starved for the truth.
And Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak.
I believe he's a hero. I believe he's coming directly from his heart, that he feels some goodness, that he believes in and loves his country, America, so strongly.
If Snowden hadn't come forward, the steady encroachment of the surveillance state would have continued, wrote John Cassidy in The New Yorker Online. Now, Big Brother and his enablers have been rattled. Seems so. The secretive Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court has posted some filings related to its major decisions on surveillance cases, and the NSA has posted some declassified files. Even Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, who'd lied to the Senate about the extent of the programs, now concedes that the time has come for a national conversation. And journalism weighed in with the prize.
The publishers of Edward Snowden's leaks have won the Pulitzer in journalism in the category of public service. The winners include reporters from The Guardian and The Washington Post newspapers. The leaks revealed the huge program that collects information about millions upon millions of American phone calls and emails.
Edward Snowden says he seeks an end to unchecked, unwarranted surveillance of citizens and allies. But his revelations also exposed CIA intercepts inside Iran, the tracking of the emails and phone calls of the Taliban in northwest Pakistan, and the hacking of computers in China, and so on. In other words, intelligence operations against current or erstwhile adversaries. So, America is divided. As usual. A January Pew poll found that 57% of people below the age of 29 believed Snowden served the public interest. But that number drops precipitously with age. And overall, even among those who praise his action, most say that the government should pursue a criminal case against him. Confusing.
You can dislike the NSA programs and also dislike Snowden.
Pew senior researcher Juliana Horowitz.
And you can think that Snowden served the public interest, but still think that what he did was criminal. It's a more nuanced story than simply Snowden's a hero or not.
An NBC poll released this week found 24% backed Snowden's actions versus 34% who opposed them. 40% had no opinion. A Rasmussen poll released Thursday says 42% think he's a spy. Coverage of the latest leak about facial recognition was comparatively scant and unremarked upon. But if the steady drip, drip, drip of reveals has produced some Snowden revelation fatigue, there's still ample interest in Snowden himself. Brian Williams' interview with him last week won its 10 p.m. time slot in the coveted 18 to 49 demographic. Glenn Greenwald's Snowden book, No Place to Hide, is becoming a movie. Oliver Stone plans a Snowden biopic. And Beyond, the Edward Snowden story, the comic book, is already out. That, at least, adds some literal color to a year-long story that has been told almost entirely in black and white.
This week, the Supreme Court said it would not intervene on behalf of New York Times reporter James Risen, who could go to jail for refusing to identify a confidential source. Risen was subpoenaed to testify in the government's case against former CIA officer Jeffrey Sterling, who was charged with leaking classified information. The government says Sterling is the source for a chapter in Risen's 2006 book, State of War, and it needs Risen to confirm that in court. At issue here is the question of reporter's privilege, essentially whether a journalist should be legally protected from having to testify about confidential information or sources. In the 1972 landmark case Brandsburg versus Hayes, the High Court ruled that reporter's privilege is not constitutionally protected and has chosen not to readdress the question for Risen. But as University of Chicago law professor Jeffrey Stone points out, Brandsburg does not preclude laws to protect journalists from having to rat out their sources.
In fact, in the years since Brandsburg, 49 states and the District of Columbia have enacted laws that in varying degrees guarantee journalists just such a privilege. All the court held in Brandsburg is that the First Amendment of its own force does not provide that protection.
Now, the Obama administration is in a rather strange position. On the one hand, it has prosecuted leakers and subpoenaed journalists at historic rates, but Attorney General Eric Holder has said that he has no interest in putting journalists behind bars. What are the options for the government to have its way without acting egregiously against a journalist just doing his job?
Well, if the government pursues the matter, they would not say they were acting egregiously. They would basically say that here it's not about the journalist simply receiving classified information. It's the journalist being in possession of critical knowledge that is necessary to enable the government to prosecute someone who violated laws dealing with the national security. The administration clearly does not want to be putting James Risen in prison, doesn't want to do that. On the other hand, it doesn't want to give individuals with access to classified information the notion that they have a free ride if they want to leak classified information, because if they give it to a reporter, the reporter can never be required to reveal their identities, and therefore they might as well just leak information whenever they feel like it. This is not necessarily about the harm done to the national security by any particular leak. It's the fact that people who have access to classified information are not allowed to leak. And from their standpoint, that's what has to be stopped.
The Senate passed a bill which would have provided federal shield protection for journalistic privilege, and it got nowhere in the House. But what would its provisions have been had it passed?
Well, it would have given substantial protection to journalists in the context of ordinary criminal investigations. And that's critical, and that's the vast majority of circumstances nationally in which this issue arises. On the other hand, it gave the government much greater authority to override a claim privilege when national security issues are at stake. So whether it would have protected Risen or not would depend on the specific facts of the case. But my guess reading the statute is that it probably wouldn't have protected Risen in this situation. My own view, for what it's worth, is that journalists should have a privilege, and that privilege should apply even in national security cases, unless the government can demonstrate that overriding the privilege is necessary not merely to convict a leaker, but also to protect against future dangers to the nation.
Great idea. All we have to do then is determine who, in a world when anybody can publish with a smartphone, actually is a journalist. It's not quite as clear-cut as it was in the analog good old days.
Well, this is one of the two issues that have really hung up the Congress. One of them is the question of when is a journalist protected, when national security is an issue. All the states that have adopted shield laws don't really face the problem of national security in the same way. And the second one, of course, is, well, who gets to claim the privilege? And there are different interest groups that have strong positions there. The sort of established, well-recognized media are perfectly comfortable with a rule that basically protects them. But obviously, there's a whole new world of media, including people like myself, who write blogs periodically, who say, hey, I'm a journalist, I should be able to have the same privilege, and so should every Tom, Dick, and Harry. You know, my own view is that the idea of this privilege is to be able to have the source know that there are people to whom she can go who can protect her confidentiality. It doesn't require that everybody who would like to be called a journalist has that privilege. What matters is that if you want to get information out to the public, and that's the reason for allowing the privilege, that there are people who are reasonably well identified, who individuals who want to communicate to the public are able to go to. Most states have managed this problem without too much difficulty. They've defined who's covered by it in all different ways from one state to the other, and that's not really been a terrible problem. There are going to be winners and losers out there, but that shouldn't be the critical issue for the Congress. They should be able to resolve that the way 49 states have managed to resolve it. There's no right or wrong answer, but you just have to draw a line, and it's going to be somewhat arbitrary.
Okay, I'd like to ask you this question. What's going to happen here?
You know, it's a great question as to what's going to happen here. At some point, either the administration is going to let Risen take a pass, and that presumably will make it impossible for the government to convict this individual, or they will insist that Risen disclose the information, and he will refuse to do so, and he'll be held in contempt, and he will go to jail for a period of time. Then they'll say, okay, we're done, and they still won't get the information they want. So it's kind of a no-win situation on both sides. You know, the administration's concern is not only that they won't be able to convict this particular individual, but that if they can't convict him, that will essentially invite others who would engage in illegal leaks to do so with the knowledge that they can be protected and that they'll never get caught. Understandably, from the government's perspective, that's a bad outcome. The government clearly doesn't want to put, you know, a New York Times journalist in jail. But, you know, my guess is push comes to shove, they'll do that.
Jeff, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jeffrey Stone is a professor of law at the University of Chicago.
Coming up, things to do on the internet when you're dead.
These services like Lives On, what they really are, is there a way for you to have control beyond your physical life?
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by LegalZoom. Find out how LegalZoom can help you start and protect your business through incorporation, LLCs, nonprofits, trademarks, and more. LegalZoom has helped start over 1 million businesses and received an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau. LegalZoom provides self-help services and can connect you with an attorney, but they're not a law firm. More information at LegalZoom.com. Enter OTM in the referral box at checkout for a special discount for On the Media listeners.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Earlier this week, the Environmental Protection Agency rolled out the Obama administration's ambitious proposal to drastically cut carbon pollution from power plants by the year 2030.
This plan cuts carbon pollution by building a clean energy economy, using more clean energy, less dirty energy, and wasting less energy throughout our economy.
More clean energy, less dirty energy. Put that way, how can you say no? Especially when real action is needed to solve the pressing problem of, climate change, man-made climate change, global warming, global weirding. Leaving aside which is most accurate, which term is most likely to inspire policies to confront the problem or not confront it? In 2002, Republican strategist Frank Luntz sent a secret memo to the Bush White House asking that very question. And, of course, answering it. Here's Luntz in a 2006 CBC documentary.
Global warming suggests something more cataclysmic. Climate change suggests something more gradual, something that takes place over time. Global warming is more frightening. Climate change is less so.
So the Bush administration effectively banned the term global warming and replaced it with climate change. Now, 12 years later, the media pretty much use the terms interchangeably. But maybe they shouldn't. Anthony Leiserwitz is the director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication and a chief researcher of the new study, What's in a Name, Global Warming versus Climate Change. He was trying to gauge the relative power of each phrase on the general public.
What we found is that the terms really do seem to still elicit very different kinds of reactions. The term global warming led to greater certainty that the phenomenon is happening, greater understanding that human activities are the primary cause, and greater worry about the issue, including a sense of personal threat. And that was true not just across the whole country, but even among specific subgroups like Hispanics or liberals or Generation X or Generation Y. So while the terms are often used interchangeably by the media, by politicians, by scientists, among the general public, the two terms don't yet quite mean the same thing.
Now, obviously, this terminology has political ramifications, how people respond to different ways of phrasing the same problem, but not necessarily the obvious implications. For example, there was a feeling in the advocacy community that it was better to talk to Republicans using the less loaded term in order to keep their attention. You researched this phenomenon.
That's right. And we still found that Republicans engage this issue more when it's called global warming. It generated stronger feelings that this is a bad thing, stronger perceptions that they are personally or that their own family is personally at threat, and even to believe that global warming is already affecting weather in the United States. So it does suggest among Republicans as well as the rest of the country that, again, the term global warming just still is more engaging.
Now, one of the apparent effects of global climate change is a lot of severe weather. And I wonder if you investigated whether the ongoing devastation of more frequent tropical storms, tornadoes, drought, and so forth skew perceptions in one direction or another in terms of language choice.
About 8 out of 10 Americans tell us that they have personally experienced one or more natural weather disasters in the past couple years. And moreover, a third of Americans say that they have been personally harmed by one or more of these events. We ask Americans, what's the first word or phrase that comes to mind when you hear global warming or climate change? We knew that climate change was generally more strongly associated with changes in weather. But when we looked within people's associations to that, we nonetheless found that global warming was actually much more strongly associated with references to extreme weather. So weather disasters, hurricanes, tornadoes, etc., those were still much more likely to be associated with global warming than they were with climate change.
One of the problems with communicating the idea of the stakes of global climate change is ideology, belief systems that simply do not square with reality, with data, with scientific evidence. People have their minds set and aren't really fixing to change them. In that environment, does a choice of terminology really matter?
Throughout many years of our work, we've identified a phenomenon that's called, in psychology, motivated reasoning. That there are some people who are so convinced that climate change is here and happening and is such an enormously serious problem. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have those who dismiss the reality and the seriousness, and in fact, many of them think it's a hoax. Those two extremes of the people who are really, really worried about it and those people who think it's a hoax, they've already made up their minds very, very strongly. And so new information that contradicts what they already believe is highly unlikely to be accepted. And it's not because they're worried about the problem itself. What they're worried about is the potential policy solution, because it is the ultimate collective action problem. I mean, as important it is for all of us to take our own individual actions of reducing energy at home and on the road and insulating your attic and doing all those good things which are part of the solution, in the end, voluntary action is not going to solve this. It's going to require state-level action, national action, and yes, global coordinated action. And to people with this deeply individualistic worldview, that's fighting words. So if you're talking to, for instance, someone who is convinced that climate change is a hoax and a big conspiracy, it doesn't matter what you call it.
Have you come up with another coinage that might replace climate change and global warming, something maybe all-inclusive and yet more terrifying?
There have been a number of alternatives proposed. Some people prefer the term climate disruption or climate chaos, or Tom Friedman has promoted global weirding as an example. But in the end, I don't believe we're going to change out and replace the term climate change or global warming in most people's minds. If you were Coca-Cola and you wanted to come up with a new name for your soft drink, you'd have to spend billions of dollars and it would take decades of hard work to get people to stop using the term Coke and switch over to a new term. For better or for worse, we've been using the terms global warming and climate change for decades. And so, you know, the idea that we can just simply change the term and that's going to suddenly change the way the world as a whole responds to this issue, I think is highly unlikely.
I don't know. Frank Luntz made quite a career doing that. In fact, let me go Luntz in on you. Ready, Anthony? Death weather.
Oh, my. I'm not going to endorse that.
Scholars. So annoyingly rigorous. Anthony, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Anthony Leiserwitz is director of the Yale Project on Climate Change Communication and principal investigator of the new study, What's in a Name? Global Warming versus Climate Change. Sorry, but I gotta start this segment with a bleak bit of news. We're all going to die. But until then, we're all going to Instagram, Facebook, tweet, and blog. Trouble is, our online legacies do not automatically revert to the control of our heirs, who are often frustrated or worse when they can't access the digital property of their dearly departed. A group of volunteers called the Uniform Law Commission is trying to sort this out with model legislation called the Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act, or FADA. The goal is to give executors and other legal proxies access to files created by the deceased. Lawyer Suzanne Brown Walsh is the chair of FADA, which would liberate Facebook and other services from existing privacy restrictions.
Providers aren't allowed to disclose communications content to family members or personal representatives. So our act seeks to give fiduciaries access to that protected communications content.
So when I die, what happens to my Facebook account?
Well, nothing happens until someone tells Facebook that you've died, and we've all heard the statistic that there are over 30 million Facebook accounts that belong to the deceased. Facebook does have a procedure for memorialization that allows a family member or someone with authority to notify Facebook and memorialize your account.
Which means what? That it stays up there, but nobody can fiddle with it?
That's correct. But there isn't a procedure for ongoing control, and that's been the rub for the family members. Some family members want access to more than the publicly available content, particularly those with family members who've died suddenly and without explanation.
And then just the ephemera of life stored in the cloud by Facebook, let's say, photos and videos and other memories that next of kin have no access to when, let's say, a child dies.
That's right, Bob. And in many cases, the assets with sentimental value are the most important ones to family.
Give me some horror stories of next of kin who have felt deprived of what is due to them.
The one incident I've had in my practice involved the adult child of an 85-year-old who controlled her family's finances, and she passed before her husband, and not a single person in the family had access to the passwords and the financial information, which was all on her computer. We have heard stories in our drafting committee of businesses which have failed, guardians acting for incapables who've needed to send invoices out to keep money coming in to pay hospital bills.
Some people make their living on the internet, producing content of various kinds. Does the conflict between survivors' rights and privacy affect assets that actually have a significant financial value as well? I mean, is there money at stake in this question?
The example we've consistently used in our drafting committee discussions is my great American novel that I'm writing in the evening and I'm uploading to Google Docs or some sort of cloud-based storage account. The famous example would be Stieg Larsson, who wrote the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo trilogy. If I were him and I were drafting my novel and I kept uploading it and it was almost finished and I didn't leave anyone a copy on a hard drive or printed, my personal representative and my family would need to access that manuscript, capture the value, and then sell the manuscript to the publisher.
Let's just say that among the ways I use the internet is to carry on a secret life. I'm doing that because I don't want the people in my actual flesh and blood life to know about it. Then I am hit by a milk truck and I'm dead. All of a sudden, the executor of the state can go and share in my secrets that I don't want revealed. Will the law that you've drafted address that situation?
Absolutely. We've coined a phrase for it. We've called it digital death. For example, I can draft a document that says, hands off of this, it's private. And our act says that's perfectly fine.
Is there another side on this that is going to attempt to stymie your efforts with proposed legislation of its own that goes in an entirely different direction?
We had some providers who actively participated in our work, attended all of our meetings. Some of them parted ways with us because they disagreed with some of the decisions we made in drafting our act. There's a couple things. Number one, we have that provision that says you can't bury something in a terms of service agreement that prohibits fiduciary access. They would like to do that. There's a cost, they say, associated with an upfront opt-out. They do not want our act to require provider compliance because, they argue, the federal privacy law does not mandate disclosure. So their request was that our statute be effectively optional.
Now, you are not legislators. This is a template. It's sample legislation that you're going to put in the hands of state legislatures around the country and hope that they enact verbatim. But, of course, that won't happen 50 times. What will happen with this proposed law?
What typically happens is groups of lawyers who practice in this area in each state convene, review the uniform legislation, adjust it as needed to state law, and then find a sponsor and propose it. We've been fortunate. We have members of the drafting committee who are from state bar groups who've actually come to the meetings, many of them who track what we do. So I know that there are probably half a dozen to a dozen groups who are waiting for our final product and hope to propose it.
All right, Suzanne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Suzanne Brown Walsh is the chair of the Fiduciary Access to Digital Assets Act with the Uniform Law Commission. She's also a principal attorney at Cummings & Lockwood's Private Clients Group in West Hartford, Connecticut.
So the Uniform Law Commission's proposed law could offer a solution to this most modern of problems. But meanwhile, the private sector has stepped in. Evan Carroll, co-author of the book Your Digital Afterlife, says there's a robust array of online services tailor-made for people who want to secure the future of their own digital content pre-mortem.
That sounds a bit morbid to think about. But in reality, if you start thinking about all the photographs, the videos, the emails, all the digital information you've collected over the years, if you don't do something to make sure your heirs can access that information, chances are good they will have difficulty accessing it. Thinking about the various online services available, there are ones like SecureSafe based out of Switzerland. They're basically an online safe deposit box that allows you to put in your usernames, passwords, other important documents, and when you're gone, make sure that's shared with an heir.
There's a service that caught my eye called Dead Man's Switch. You can create a message to be sent after your death, and Dead Man's Switch asks that the users log in periodically to verify that they are still alive, and if they don't log in after 3 email reminders, then their post-death messages are sent out. That's really asking for trouble, isn't it?
It is asking for trouble. This was actually one of the earliest services that I saw come about in 2008, and it operates kind of like a train. A train operator has to have their hand on the switch in order for the train to continue running. If their hand is removed from the switch, that's when the train stops. And so this is a similar concept. I've actually signed up for Dead Man's Switch. I have effectively killed myself by ignoring all of the emails. The third email says, "We really hope to hear from you soon." And it's kind of interesting to read their increasing motivation to get you to reply.
Once you didn't reply, though, did your after-death goodbyes get sent out?
They did, in fact, get sent. And, of course, they were sent right back to me because I specified myself as the recipient.
There's one called Lives On, which learns your tweeting voice and tweets after you're dead. It has the tagline, "When your heart stops beating, you'll keep tweeting."
You know what's interesting about these services like Lives On, what they really are is they're a way for you to have control beyond your physical life. They look at the way you typically use phrases, they look at things you typically said, and they use basically artificial intelligence algorithms to figure out how you should sound in the future. They're not perfect right now, but I can only imagine that these will become more and more accurate over time.
Do you foresee a time when we just have a digital presence that would actually make a difference in the world after we're gone?
Well, let's back up and talk about Facebook and what happens to it when we're gone. Our profiles become a memorial. Let's say that you and I both know a person who has passed away, but we don't know each other ourselves. On the anniversary of their death, I might go post on their Facebook page, and you might do so as well, and perhaps we get a conversation started. The person who is no longer with us still effectively introduced you and I.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we extrapolate that out to how technology might advance and how we might have robots that continue to post on our behalf and things like that, the question I start to ask is, you know, why not? Why could we not continue to participate in society once we're gone?
Hmm.
Now, I'll also answer my question. 30 years in the future, my great-grandchildren might be able to sit down and have a conversation with me that's based upon all the tweets and emails that I had written, my opinion on current events, my mannerisms. It would certainly be synthetic, but it would be a richer experience than they might have today. But in the age-old question, just because we can, should we? I think we have to get to the point where society is willing to accept it before we can really move forward.
On the other hand, there are already a couple of services that claim to be able to do something like this, LifeNot and Eterni.me, which has got the tagline, "Simply Become Immortal." It professes to collect everything that you created during your lifetime, process it through these artificial intelligence algorithms, and then generate a virtual you.
So thinking about these services like LifeKnot or Attorney.me, these are really prototypes. And even though the results may not be quite good enough yet, if they have the content, chances are good that they'll continue to advance their technology. So if you want to have one of these available, it might make sense to start looking into them now so that in the future they might improve.
Doesn't the industry have to wrestle with the problem of just kind of creepiness?
You're absolutely right. If we still had the ability to talk to every single person who ever lived, wouldn't we find that a bit overwhelming?
Actually, the way that you put it, as long as they're not eating and creating a carbon footprint and using non-renewable resources, you know, if I could go back and talk to Galileo or something, that would be really cool.
Certainly, it would be really cool for some individuals. My question is, would we feel this obligation to tend the digital avatars of our ancestors? And would that just simply become too much over time? I'm honestly not sure. We're kind of breaking the rules of life as we have this discussion.
But I can imagine a kind of Library of Congress of characters. We don't tend them, we just plunder them when we need them for our purposes. They're not alive, after all.
You're onto an interesting notion there, that we could pull out the remote and turn Grandma on and speak to her and then say, okay, well, Grandma, this was a nice visit. We're going to put you on mute now. And there is a certain guilt you don't have in doing that because they're not really there. It would certainly be a fascinating proposition.
Evan, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Evan Carroll is co-author of the book Your Digital Afterlife. He also runs a website called The Digital Beyond.
Coming up, the viral video Fiction that created our collective memory of Tom Cruise's infamous couch jumping incident on The Oprah Show.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. We know how in this digital age, even the smallest misstep can wreck a reputation. We've seen it so often, it's easy to forget that in our ultra-connected, camera phone-toting, social media-soaked world, we didn't always operate at such a rapid boil. But cast your mind back, if you can, to viral media's Stone Age. I'm talking almost exactly 9 years ago, May 23rd, 2005. Tom Cruise is sitting on Oprah Winfrey's couch. The studio audience is stacked with pre-selected Cruise fanatics.
You've got to calm yourself. They've got to calm themselves.
The room is electrified by movie love, but the frantic fans aren't interested in Tom Cruise's new movie, War of the Worlds. They want the dish on his new girl, Katie Holmes, America's sweetheart. And Oprah, ruffling Tom's hair, holding his hand, touching his knee, wants to give them what they want.
Tom, does that mean you're going to ask her to marry you? Does that mean you're going to ask her to marry you, Tom?
Oprah, I got it today? You're late.
So does that mean you're going to ask her to marry you?
I got to discuss it with her.
You got to discuss it.
Ever the pro, Oprah digs for deets about the moment love bloomed.
How soon after meeting her did it happen? You must have thought it was going to happen. That's why you wanted to meet her, right?
Don't we have War of the Worlds, too?
Yeah, we're going to do that. We're going to do that. We're going to do that. That's why you're here. Of course I'm going to do that. I'm going to do
How
that.
How long? Okay, so what was the question again?
Tom wants to stop the line of questioning and talk about his new movie. He hears the audience scream every time he moves, so to deflect the emotional inquisition, he jumps up and down on Oprah's couch.
Have you ever felt this way before?
This is the moment, now enshrined in pop culture history, that brands Tom Cruise as an unhinged has-been. But the trouble is, it never happened, says Amy Nicholson, head film critic for the LA Weekly.
He doesn't jump on the couch. He gets up and sort of leaps on to stand on it, but he never bounces on it like a trampoline. Oprah actually gives him the idea to stand on the couch as a way of impressing her. at the very start of the episode, she says how happy she was that he attended her Legends Ball, which she had just had 2 or 3 days before. And she says to Tom, "I looked over at you, and you were standing on your chair. And I loved that enthusiasm." And I think that implants this idea in his head that if he doesn't want to answer questions or if he wants to make her happy, he should just stand up again. So he stands up on the couch. And that is how we get Tom Cruise jumping. Because we had this great freeze frame of him in midair with his knees bent and Oprah sort of looking surprised, you see the word jumps, and you picture him actually jumping, which is something that didn't happen.
What was going on in the media on the day that Tom Cruise met that fateful couch?
May 2005 is such a fascinating month. It's the month that Perez Hilton launched PerezHilton.com. It's the month that Huffington Post launched, you know, two major sites that showed the industry that you could have a huge revenue stream just by talking about gossip online. These two sites and the success of them, I think, created this echo chamber. I mean, May 2005 even predates TMZ by just a few months.
As you note in your piece, if your video went viral, bandwidth was getting used. It was expensive. But then this little company started and it made it much easier to post these videos.
Yeah, a little company called YouTube, 1 week before May, the last week of April, put up their first video, me at the zoo.
All right, so here we are, one of the elephants. Cool thing about these guys is that they have really, really, really long fronts.
YouTube shows up, and not only can you put a video up online for free, you can embed it in a website. People don't even have to leave your blog. You can draw traffic to you, and all of a sudden, we're learning how to make revenue from viral video. Completely new at the time.
I keep thinking, though, of another viral video, one that was taken wildly out of context during the presidential election, the Howard Dean scream.
And we go to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan, and then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House. Yeah!
He sounded somewhat demented during a campaign stop. But in context, it didn't seem nearly as loony. How did that get out there prior to YouTube?
We had a news cycle that was going 24/7 on cable channels. That kind of spread into news blogs. I feel like news blogs were a little bit ahead of the time.
Was Tom Cruise one of the first celebrities to stumble into the pitfalls of celebrity viral media?
He was definitely the biggest, which I think is why the story of his stumble almost became the story itself and not the facts of what was actually happening.
He was, you claim, more or less untouchable prior to this moment because he was so, so careful.
Tom Cruise keeps his private life incredibly private. Right after Risky Business, he was 22, 23 at the time. He was part of this cool kids group that was about to be dubbed the Brat Pack. He thought, I can't get lumped in with that because that's one way to just become the next Judd Nelson and nobody remembers you in 10 years.
So after a stay in London, rather than taking on starring roles himself, he returns and chooses to play second fiddle to enormous stars, both of whom win Academy Awards for their roles, Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man and Paul Newman, in this clip, in Martin Scorsese's The Color of Money.
Big money game.
Yeah, that's right, a big money game. So why don't you take your hands off the girl and let us play, okay, guy?
What do you care where I put my hand? Why don't you mind your own business?
Hey, Gramps, put your teeth back in. Get your hands off your daughter there and pay attention. You just might learn something here today.
It's incredible for me to think of like a 25-year-old actor at that moment choosing the harder option, choosing to try to prove himself as an actor. And Rain Man to me is this a great example because not only did he choose a film about a guy who's really mean to his autistic brother, but Tom Cruise's clout made Rain Man the number one hit of the year.
These are not boxer shorts. Mine are boxer shorts.
Well, what's the difference?
These are Hanes 32. Right? These are Hanes 32. My boxer shorts have my name and it says Rain.
Well, all right. When we pass the store, we'll pick you up a pair of boxer shorts.
I get my boxer shorts at Kmart in Cincinnati.
We're not going back to Cincinnati, Ray, so don't even start with that.
400 Oak Street.
We're not going back to Cincinnati. You don't have to go to Cincinnati to pick up boxer shorts.
Yeah, it's Oak and Burnett in Cincinnati.
What did I say, Ray?
It's Kmart.
You hear me. I know you hear me.
Yeah, my boxer shorts
don't
have my...
Don't fool me with this for a second.
Yours are too tight.
Ray, did you f***ing hear what I said? Shut up!
Think about that now. In 2014, this is a summer of blockbusters, superhero movies. He made a film about an autistic grown-up not getting along with his brother. The number one box office hit.
Talk to me about his management. This seems arcane, but actually it figures a great deal in your article.
Sure. Tom Cruise partnered with Pat Kingsley, who's this very old school, incredibly smart publicist. She had a lot of huge clients that she could dole out and then withhold from papers if they didn't do what she wanted. And she used all of her force to sort of bend journalists to her will. She was determined to keep his name as far away from Star and the Enquirer as possible.
But ultimately, he replaces her with his sister. Why does he do that?
It was a moment where he started to feel like he needed to talk more about Scientology openly. I think that was a tough call for both of them because he wanted to represent his faith, which was starting to become under attack from the media, and say, I'm the biggest movie star in the world. Let me try to make my religion sound normal to people. And she had the competing interest of having the studios tell her, don't let him do that. We can't let our movies get derailed by talk of his religion. He realized, and she realized, that they needed to go their separate ways.
I have to ask you, some of this is clearly self-inflicted.
It's true that it's a religion he very clearly believes in deeply that is sort of held up for public ridicule, which is why I tried to even downplay Scientology a bit in the piece.
A little bit too much, perhaps.
Perhaps a little bit too much, but I also just felt like that story has been told. We know all about Tom Cruise and Scientology, and I find it interesting that we don't hold up other actors to the same sort of scrutiny for their beliefs. But the sort of things Tom Cruise says about Scientology, we tune out when it's a football player spiking a touchdown and then thanking God. I think it's a little bit strange that the rest of us do nothing but pick on somebody's religion.
But that doesn't excuse him from passing judgment on Brooke Shields for using antidepressants, does it? This is Tom Cruise speaking to Matt Lauer on the Today Show in 2005.
Before I was a Scientologist, I never agreed with psychiatry. And then when I started studying the history of psychiatry, I started realizing more and more why I didn't agree with psychiatry. And as far as the Brooke Shields thing is, look, you got to understand, I really care about Brooke Shields. I want to see her do well. And I know that psychiatry is a pseudoscience.
He's not trying to legislate his beliefs. Here, he was just expressing an opinion. I wish we sort of directed the ire that we directed towards him equally to the ire of politicians and the public eye who are using their religious beliefs to actually take away medicine.
I think we kind of pick on everyone, don't we?
I think we pick on them a little disproportionately.
The title of your piece in the LA Weekly was How YouTube and Internet Journalism Destroyed Tom Cruise, Our Last Real Movie Star. But you argue he wasn't destroyed at all. In fact, he's never had a flop.
Exactly. I think what's so interesting is the perception of his destruction. That summer that Tom Cruise went on Oprah's couch, the story became, has Tom Cruise ruined his career by going crazy? And what never got put into the story is the fact that the movie he was promoting, War of the Worlds, was his biggest hit of all time. No matter what the numbers are, if the story exists that his career is over, everything's been shaped to fit that narrative. I always say that Tom Cruise is the greatest actor of his generation who's hiding in plain sight. Because after this sort of shakeup, where even he was rattled and thought that maybe the public had fallen out of love with him, he decided to do the safest film projects possible, which are sci-fi films, action films, and mashups of sci-fi and action films, to try to prove that he still has box office clout. Occasionally he'll show up and be like the best thing in a cameo, like he did with Tropic Thunder.
You know how you handle an actor? They whine about anything. You pull down their pants and you spank their ass.
You spank that ass, Les.
I think that his character in Tropic Thunder is kind of a joke on Sumner Redstone after firing him from Paramount. The explanation that Redstone gave to the press was, Tom Cruise is a fine actor, but he's committing career suicide and costing us revenue. It's so strange because he wasn't. Cruise actually was responsible for making 32% of the studio's entire profits. That's one actor and 32%.
When exactly did you become a Tom Cruise fan?
I became a Tom Cruise fan last year while researching my book, actually. I started to write the book under the same impression that everybody else had of Tom Cruise, that he's really great as a personality and as a charismatic movie star, and that he's not much as an actor. And I thought in digging into his career, I would be exploring how does an average talent turn himself into a superstar? And then going back and actually watching the roles, I realized I'm completely wrong. His whole career has been about trying to prove himself as an actor and almost being a movie star in despite of himself.
So what do we take away from Tom Cruise's tar and feathering by viral video?
right now in the media, we're also quick to see a headline, hear of somebody messing up. There's like an instant shaming. What I've taken away from this is even though I see a headline in a video, it doesn't mean I know the full story. It's given me a reminder that I need to pause before I shoot off like a mean tweet or a joke at somebody else's expense, because I think reality is a lot more complicated than the internet condenses it.
And he didn't jump on that couch.
And he didn't jump on that couch.
Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke. This has been great.
Amy Nicholson is the head film critic for the LA Weekly. Her new book is called Tom Cruise, Anatomy of an Actor. And it'll be published by Cahiers du Cinéma at the end of July.
Tame it! Take it on head first with the skills that I will teach you at work and say, Noah!
No!
You will not control me! Noah!
No!
You will not take my soul! Noah!
No!
You will not win this game! Because it is a game, guys. You want to think it's not, huh?
That's Tom Cruise in Magnolia.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Mira Sharma, and Kimmy Regler. We had more help from Andrew Chug, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rick Kwan.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.